Well, this is Jerry Pippin, and we are here in Eureka Springs, Arkansas, at the Ozark UFO Conference. And this is the 20th year, Ted Phillips.
Yes.
I met you here several years ago for the first time.
Indeed, yes.
And we had a great show. Mm-hmm. And you talked about this thing you found in a cave over where, in Yugoslavia or someplace?
Slovakia.
Okay, that was close.
Yeah. in the neighborhood.
why don't you tell us a little bit about that right off the bat for people who, we do still have that interview available if people would like to find it. We had your picture there on a gallery of guests, and click on Ted Phillips' picture and you can hear it. But give us a recap here of what's happening.
Yeah, the what we're calling it currently is Project Moonshaft, and
why did you guys name it that?
Well, the gentleman that found it, a Czech engineer, Antonin Hurok, was hidden in the cave from the Germans in October of 1944 during the war, and when he finally reached this thing a couple of miles deep in the cavern, it was a sort of vertical shaft, and the overall shape of this structure is sort of a fat crescent moon. And so he named it the Moon Shaft, and so we've kind of carried that along. And
Now, have we figured out what that stuff's made of?
No, we don't know. I've been to Slovakia on two occasions, yes.
Mm-hmm.
And each time by myself, and it's you can't get quite enough done under those circumstances. But I did find what I believe is the cave, and there are a lot of indicators in the first couple of thousand feet of the cave. And I have the original 1944 sketch of the cavern in great detail from Hurok, and at least the first 2,000 feet it matches the sketch. And unfortunately, in the early 1945, the Russians did a lot of aerial bombing in that area, and craters are still visible, and it has shaken the cave a couple of thousand feet in, and it was pretty risky for a single individual to try to get through the area. It's possible. I mean, I could have done it, but not very wise.
Now when we talk about this this object, does it put off some sort of vibration or tone or something?
Well, I could detect from the surface with a electromagnetic field meter and also compasses, by placing them in this one area, each time I would pass through it on the surface, batteries on the equipment would start dying off and just were dead. And so the third trip through, I took the EM meter and three compasses, and I placed them on the ground in this area, set up the camcorder on a tripod, backed it out of the area, and zoomed in. And all of these instruments were swinging in two-second sweeps. So what was being picked up was a magnetic emission, and on the trifield meter, an electromagnetic emission. And the interesting thing was, about a week after I did that, I found the cave entrance, and in exploring the cave, I surveyed it, and it was actually turning back in the direction of this area. And the Russians also have found very old manuscripts where villagers described a large, dark object, a curved object that came out of the sky with a great deal of noise and landed on the ground. And the villagers could see it from miles away. It was that tall. But gradually, it was getting shorter. And finally, it disappeared over a period of about 4 weeks. And the villagers went into the area, and they found not the object, but a large opening in the ground where evidently this thing had somehow pushed itself deep in underground.
So either it was really heavy or it forced its way down there or something.
Yeah. And it was, you know, it was making ear-splitting sounds, whatever that might indicate. But the really interesting thing is the Russians, this particular Russian scientist I'm in contact with, in going into that area, found an electromagnetic emission pulsing on 2 seconds coming out of this hole. So perhaps there are two.
And you think it's still pulsing?
Yes. Oh, yes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And this is one reason you think you found the location of the White Cave.
Yes, exactly.
And your last trip, you made it a couple thousand feet down?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
What are we talking about here? Is it like a spelunker you trip through Merrimack Cave or something? or are we talking about a little hole in the ground? Or what are we talking about?
Oh, no, it's quite a large cavern. The entrance is very small and low, but the cavern immediately opens up, and it's a very complex cave system, at least the first 2,000 feet. And
by complex, you mean it has lots of entrances or
lots of side passages, other channels that
and,
you could travel.
And this fellow who was hiding from the Nazis.
Yes.
How did you find out about him? Was it a diary or something?
Well, I had a friend in 1970 give me a call, and he said, "I have a neighbor you need to talk to." And he knew of my interest, number one, in caves and also in physical evidence relating to UFOs. And so he briefly went through the story, and in less than 2 weeks I was out there. And my wife and I spent 2 days with Hurok and his wife Anna and at their home. And we viewed the 1944 original diary that he'd maintained through the war. And while he was in the cavern and inside the structure, he sketched the object. He measured it very carefully. He was an engineer with 4 degrees in engineering, linguistics, and business management. Very intelligent man. And, of course, when the Nazis invaded Czechoslovakia and Poland, they arrested him, put him in a concentration camp, took everything that he and his wife had, and he escaped in 1941 from the concentration camp into Slovakia and joined the Slavic Underground Army. Mm-hmm. And it was during a large firefight with the Nazis that he and two of his men were seriously injured and wounded, and they woke up the next morning with Slavic, a Slovakian sheepman, treating their wounds, building a stretcher, and he took them to this cave and hid them in the High Tatra Mountains. It's a pretty remarkable story.
Yeah, it certainly is, and we talk about that. You're pretty certain that this was an object that fell from the sky because of the stories you've heard or read.
Since then, yes.
The original thing when you told me about the story several years ago, I was thinking about maybe it's the Ark of the Covenant.
Well, you know, you do start thinking along those terms the fascinating thing about this artifact structure is that the outer wall, which was, of course, the first thing he saw, 2 miles back in the cave, 2,700 feet below the mountaintop. And the outer wall, the exposed area, was framed with cave formations, flowstone and limestone and stalactites. And they were affixed to the wall, the outside of the wall. Well, one thing we know is how long it takes those types of formations to grow. And we're talking many thousands of years. And there was a crack in this wall. The wall itself, as he went through it, measured 7 feet in thickness. And when he was in the interior of this thing, this moon-shaped structure, it went up to an unknown height. He could see, he could light it about 100 feet above him. And it went on. And below him, the very fascinating thing is there is a incline which he thought was the floor of the inside of this thing. And it was a limestone deposit. And he took his military pickaxe and he chopped through this stuff in one of the horns of the crescent and found that it was 60 inches thick. Well, 60 inches of limestone equals about 6,000 years of deposit inside this thing that has flowstone formations on the outer wall. Beneath the 6,000 years of limestone, he finds the skeleton of a very large animal. And he brought out two of the teeth with him, and after the war, had them identified by one of the leading paleontologists as prehistoric cave bear. So we have underneath 6,000 years of limestone the skeleton of a prehistoric cave bear, which has to be over...
How big would that be?
The cave bear was about 20 feet long, and they weighed about 2 tons.
You
very large.
You wouldn't want to run
no.
into one.
No, you would not. And but the age of the cave bear would be somewhere beyond 100,000 years. Mm-hmm. So you're beginning to add up the fact that this thing is very, very old. And the cave bear skeleton was lying on what he described as a constructed wavy grill work. And he thought he could feel heat coming up through it from below, put his ear and cheek against the grill, and could feel warm air coming up, which is a rarity in deep caverns. And at some great distance below him, and remember, this is a very trained, highly trained engineer used to the underground, he could hear what sounded like a large turbine running. So
I remember when you related that story, mm-hmm. that's where I got, it was making some sort of noise.
Yes, exactly. And so, you know, I have the feeling this is something that should be looked at.
Hey, and I understand you're putting another expedition together.
Yes,
maybe.
Right. Yeah, the team, as soon as we get the proper funding to do the
What would an underwriter need to do to get a hold of you? You got a great website now.
Oh, it is. Adam Johnson, our webmaster, has done an incredible job with this. And, just go to ufophysical.com. And click on Project Moonshaft, and you can read the original diary. Sketches from the diary are there, along with a lot of other very current and interesting information. So, yeah, we're very proud of the website. Absolutely.
I don't know. I don't know how one goes about getting funding for these sort of things, but I guess. Maybe somebody listening, you never know. They might be interested.
Exactly. And, of course, we do
have... do you work with a university or anything like that?
We've not had any real luck.
Yeah.
The problem is, unless you have photographs of such a thing, you know, they're not willing to go out on a limb and invest. But there are private individuals. A friend of mine who was the CEO of a very large web company, funded the second trip over. And, you know, it would not require a tremendous amount of money. Just all we're looking for is enough to get the job done right.
And they can get in touch with you through that website.
Yes, right.
Mm-hmm. I noticed on that website you have something there called Hard Evidence, the Ted Phillips story. I want to find out about what that's all about when we come back. This is Jerry Pippin. We'll be right back.
Marvelous Marv Grand Canyon Tours offers you a unique look at one of the great wonders of the world, the Grand Canyon.
Been at the Grand Canyon area most of my life, so pretty much grew up in the area and know quite a few things that the common tourist doesn't know. And I need to avoid all the people and stuff and try to take them to secluded areas.
A day excursion, personally, conducted by Marvelous Marv.
Yeah, we started about 8 o'clock in the morning. We're done about 4:30. Absolutely. And I have a little photo CD disc for them with 1,000 of my favorite pictures and some video. And
no other tour offers so much, and no other personalized tour offers a better price.
No, I'm still the same, and I'm the most reasonable price tour of the Grand Canyon. No, $85 a person. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Call 928-707-0291 or check him out at marvelousmarv.com.
Ted Phillips is our guest, and this is Jerry Pippin, and we're broadcasting from Eureka Springs. And Ted, you've been in a lot of countries in your search for. How would you describe what you're searching for?
Well, primarily, my interest is in UFO research involving the landing of flying saucers. Mm-hmm. And in making contact with the ground, leaving behind or generating physical residue. And in other words, not just another story, but something you can put your hands on. And I started this in 1968 at the request of Dr. J. Allen Hynek. And currently we have 3,389 cases involving UFO landings and physical residue.
That many?
From 92 countries, yes.
Wow.
Yeah. A lot of data, really.
Yeah, that is.
Yes.
And what do you draw from this data?
Well, what I can see, based on the facts as they present themselves, that we're dealing with some sort of constructed devices, machines, by virtue of how they're seen, what they do when they're seen, how they interact with the soil and the immediate surrounding area. One of the great things is that in the cases of the larger objects, they land on either three legs or four. And at the end of those legs, of course, are landing pads of various configurations. And by taking compression tests in those footpad marks.
Can you figure out how heavy it is?
Exactly, yeah. And
how heavy is it?
Well, depending on the type of object, mm-hmm. The range runs from 7 to 12 tons. And so, in other words, all of a sudden we're not talking about a story, we're talking about a physical mass.
Right.
Something, without question, was there. And contrary to popular belief, UFOs are not all lights in the distance in the night sky. In the landing cases, a high percentage of those reports are made by multiple witnesses in daylight within 50 feet of the landed object. And over a period of time long enough to be sure it's not the Goodyear blimp,
sure.
Or a hot air balloon or whatever, mm-hmm. that it is indeed something very strange and out of the ordinary. And during that period of time, they see the object generating the physical evidence. And so this puts it in an entirely different light. I mean, you're dealing with something close for long duration, good seeing conditions, multiple witnesses. The best cases we have, I think.
And these things are similar worldwide?
Yes, they are. Yeah. The really fascinating thing that I learned over many years, too many years perhaps, of researching
these
things.
You'll never catch me. Go ahead. That's one good thing.
Well, the thing that I began to see was that I could go to a new case and without knowing anything about the landing site, talk to the witnesses, interview the witnesses, and determine the approximate size, configuration, description of the object. And before I even went to the site, I had a really good idea of what I was going to find. They are that repeatable. They're consistent. They're like fingerprints.
What are the size of these objects? Are they more or less about the same size, or
they're not large. You know, occasionally you hear about the 300-foot long objects,
right.
And so on. The landing devices tend to be in a range of 4 to 8 feet, 8 feet to 12, 12 to 18 feet, and those three particular
models.
Types. Yes,
yeah.
And then there's a smaller model which is less than 1 meter in diameter. And those kind of reports are very much on the increase since the late 90s, whereas the 18-foot jobs are on the decrease.
So the smaller ones, and we've talked to Adam Johnson about this,
mm-hmm.
On his what do you call that place up in Missouri? With
Marley
the,
Woods.
Yeah, Marley Woods.
Yes.
How could I forget that?
Yes.
Is that what you're talking about, something that may be robotic or something? We don't know what that is.
Yeah, obviously they have to be remotely controlled, unless they have some really little guys.
Yeah, they're really
tiny. Really. But because
reminds me of that old Twilight Zone. With
yes, yes. Yeah, boy, what classics those things were. But when you have an object that's the size of a baseball or a softball, and they are moving around on their own without wings or engines or sound, and yet they also emit an electromagnetic field that will interfere with things in the immediate area. And they'll be seen, for example, a very good example from Marley Woods. One evening, two attorneys, a man and his wife, who were total skeptics, and they'd heard about some lights being seen, so they thought, well, it'd be fun. And they're standing outside their car, 10 feet apart, and in the distance, about 1,000 feet, in a tree line, they suddenly see clusters of these small white lights moving around. And they're going from the ground to the tops of trees and in between. And suddenly, two of the objects emerge from the cluster, and they're headed directly toward the two people. And at a distance of about 150 feet, one of the objects makes a right-angle turn, flies across the field, disappears in some dense woods. The second object continues straight at these two and passes by at shoulder height between two people 10 feet apart. That's close. That's very close.
Yeah, and I think Adam told me it didn't make any noise or anything.
No noise, no air disturbance, no sensation of heating or cooling, no electrical shock. They turn, they see it fly out across the gravel road over a field, makes a right angle turn into dense woods, and it's gone.
Some sort of surveillance, maybe.
That seems to be the logical assumption. It mm-hmm. really does, mm-hmm. yes. But we're having a lot of cases like that. I mean, incredibly close.
Mm-hmm.
So our goal is to insert the team into the middle of this sort of stuff while it's going on and get imaging from several units and also gather instrument data on this stuff so we can begin to understand what's going on.
So in other words, this investigative unit that you're talking about mm-hmm. that you put together, what is it, five at this point?
Five, yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You use some high-tech examining stuff,
exactly.
taking measurements, things
yes.
like that.
Yes.
And,
mm-hmm.
It's kind of like a Ghostbusters, only it's a little...
It's a UFO Buster.
Yeah, right,
yeah.
Right, right.
Yeah. Actually, yes, that's exactly right. And, you know, for 40 years, I would find myself going in behind an event, and you're kind of picking up breadcrumbs. And I always consider the physical traces generated by these objects as fingerprints. And they are similar with similar objects. And so what we're trying to do instead of going in behind is to be there when it happens. And we have three sites now that are tremendously active. And the owners of these areas
are all these
call
in Missouri?
Us, yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And they call us even while they're observing something. And what the pattern indicates over the past 10 years is that when activity begins, you'll have anywhere from 5 to 7 nights of this activity. So we have plenty of time to get there, be there, and observe it.
Now when we talk about that and these three sites, what do you think is so interesting that something would be there?
You know,
the same places over and over.
Yeah, I have looked at everything I can think of, and there's nothing remarkable or unique about these areas. And yet, what makes them tremendously unique is I could stand in my backyard for the next 100 years and not see any of this.
True.
And yet, in these specific areas, you can. Now, why? I don't know. But that's what we're trying to find out. That's one of the legs we're trying to get down. So,
you talked about footprints and fingerprints earlier. Any evidence of real ET prints on any of these landings?
Some man getting out, or some being. Now, I would immediately point out that these these active sites that I just talked about, they have had just about every kind of sighting that you could expect, except no humanoids, no little guys, and no abductions. But in the landing cases, 20% of the 3,389 cases involve little guys.
Really?
Yes. Yeah, which seems to be a pretty high number. And
yeah, it's 700.
Yes. Yeah, oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and from many of the 92 countries. And yet they're described consistently as 3.5 feet tall, thin, spindly bodies, large heads. And by people in countries where they don't read the National Enquirer. So they're not getting the ideas from somewhere else. And I have been fortunate enough to see a number of the footprints from supposedly these little guys.
Do they have shoes?
Sort of.
Okay.
Yeah, they're not. Well, they're not barefoot unless they have really odd feet.
Uh-huh.
And but the really interesting thing is I've been able to run compression tests on the footprints, indicating that whoever left them weighed about 60 pounds, which would be consistent with a 3 foot individual, if I could call them an individual.
Sure.
But anyway,
well, I call them people. They're an entity of some sort.
Yes, they are. Yes, they
are intelligent enough to get in this machine and get here.
Exactly. Yeah, and one would suspect to build that machine.
Yes.
So,
as you mentioned, that's one of the common denominators that you figured out.
Right. Yes.
I know you went up to Aztec recently,
yes.
And we're going to get into that in a minute. I'm going to have to take a break here in a moment first, but I've got to ask you, what is this about here on the website? You got a new book or something, or is that just your PR man?
That's the PR man, our website guy.
Yeah, he says right there, and that got my attention. So I said, print that off. I'm going to ask Ted about that.
Yeah, hard evidence, the Ted Phillips story.
and so
I'm not sure I've read that even.
Yeah. So the Ted Phillips story has not, well, I don't know. I think it's May 22nd, Indiana Jones comes back.
Exactly. Yeah, I can't wait. I love those movies.
You're not Indiana Jones?
Well, there were times in Slovakia I sort of felt that way.
I want to get back to the footprints and the investigations of the landings and up at Aztec and find out what really went on up there. I know you went to the site, right?
Yes, yes.
This is Jerry Pippin. Ted Phillips is with us. And the name of this organization now is?
The
Security?
SIU.
Yes.
Special Investigations Unit.
Special Investigating. I like that. We need to get a reality show going here.
Exactly.
Hey,
yes.
Hey, that's
yes.
a good idea.
Absolutely.
Quick, Roberta, write that down.
Contact us.
I'll take 10%. Anyway, I'm Jerry Pippin. I'll be right back.
The doors are finally open at shopjerrypippin.com. Explore our new iShop. It's open and growing. You can use any major credit card or your checking account with our PayPal connection. Our first edition t-shirt selections features 3 different Jerry Pippin UFO files designs. In addition, we will be adding collector t-shirts from select UFO conferences, as well as several novelty items. Check us out at shopjerrypippin.com.